Today, Charlie Cushman's going to call in. If you've listened to this show in the past, you've heard Charlie Cushman, one of the finest banjo players in the world, and he's also a certified banjo geek. Charlie can take a banjo and set it up and make it the absolute maximum power sound that you're ever going to get out of a banjo. He sets up everybody's banjo to make them sound the best they possibly can, and he's a wizard at it. But Charlie's going to come in and talk about stuff he does to banjos, where he's playing, what he's been doing, and you almost always hear cuts either from his solo albums or he did some really great fiddle duet stuff with Johnny Warren, son of Paul Warren, and it's just a great little story how they got together and put that together. But you hear some of that, and you'll hear from Charlie 3, and send me questions in the chat room if you want me to address them to Charlie. Right now on the phone is Charlie Cushman. Hey, Charlie, how you doing?
Great to see you. How are you today?
Doing pretty good, man. I know you're a busy guy. I appreciate you taking the time to call in. I will tell you that we've been talking you up all morning. I played a couple of the tunes from the first duets album you did with Johnny Warren, and I played a tune of yours, as I almost always do every Saturday. And so everybody's here listening in, and I thought we would just chat about what you're up to. And since I just played those Johnny Warren and you a couple of those albums, tell me a little bit about how those things came about, because I know that you have a special connection with Johnny, and of course we know who Paul is, but you can explain that a little more too also.
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks for playing our stuff on there.
Hey. I just play good music, Charlie. You just happen to be it.
Well, we do what we do, you know. About the Paul Warren tribute records, I guess it was about 2007, Johnny and I started talking about this box of tapes that he found in his closet that had been up there many, many years, and he'd forgotten about them. And on these tapes were, these were reel-to-reel tapes. On these tapes were a bunch of fiddle tunes that his dad had recorded with various people on a home recorder. These tunes were tunes that, as we have found out later, are kind of known by other names. A lot of fiddle tunes have two or three aliases as time marches on. But anyway, this box of tapes contained a bunch of tunes that Paul had put down with Charlie Collins, with Johnny playing guitar, Larry McNeely, and Charlie Collins used to come over to Paul's house and do a bunch of jamming on Sunday afternoons. Anyway, his idea was to learn these tunes and teach them to me, and basically started out as he wanted to do kind of a scrapbook for his family regarding the legacy of his dad.
Now you had known Johnny for a long time, right?
Right. Johnny and I met when I first moved to Nashville in 1978, right after high school, and had played a lot of music together during those years. And anyway, I was a big fan of his dad's, of course, still am.
Well, and tell the listeners, Charlie, I have, but explain to them where Paul Warren fits in the legacy of bluegrass. Just a second.
Well, Paul Warren was a southern boy. He grew up in the community of Lyles, Tennessee, which is down in Hickman County. Hickman County is was rich back in those days. Howdy Forrester came from there. Fiddling Arthur Smith, who was Paul Warren's idol, came from those parts. And Paul used to listen to the radio and hear Arthur Smith playing on the Opry and try to memorize these tunes on his dad's fiddle. And, of course, he got pretty good at it and later became real good friends with Arthur Smith. And anyway, to jump ahead, Paul was enlisted into the military and World War II, and spent 29 months in a German concentration camp where he basically fiddled for his life. Mm-hmm. He traded a German guard a pack of American cigarettes for an old beat-up fiddle, and when they found out that he could play the fiddle, they basically called on him and became, I guess, befriended him, you know.
Wow. I've never heard this story before, any of this. This is unbelievable. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm stunned.
Well, anyway, yeah, there's a lot to tell about that story. And, you know, you should probably talk to Johnny and get him to really give you the right atmosphere for that. But anyway, and after he was released, he came back to Tennessee and started work with Johnny Wright and Jack Anglin. He wound up playing fiddle on Kitty Wells' record, The Wolf of God, who made Honky Tonk Angels.
Yeah.
That's where his association with commercial country music began. A few years later, 1954, Ben Martin was working with Lester Earl, and Paul Warren was contacted about an open spot in the band for the fiddle player. His name was having a few health problems, as we call it. Anyway, Paul went to work with Lester Earl, and I think the first tune he cut with them was "Your Mom Dropped in the Bucket."
Hmm.
And anyway, after working over 20 years with Lester Flatt, and most of that tenure with Lester Earl, he became one of the most visible fiddlers in this type of music, with all of their television and radio and Grand Ole Opry appearances, personal appearances across the country. And it was, you know, basically the ultimate side
band. Yeah. In 2007, then, when you say Johnny found these tapes, was he actively playing in music at the time?
No. Just maybe a job here and there. Johnny is a certified PGA golf instructor. And he was on the road in the early 80s with Curly Sittler and the National Grass. Playing fiddle with them, along with Jimmy Ingram and the other guys there. And golf became as much a passion with Johnny as fiddling did. And as it turned out, you know, it was a more lucrative, secure way to make a living. So Johnny now has his own golf academy.
Wow.
In Gallup, Tennessee, where he instructs folks how to play golf and improve their technique. And so he's got a very secure living doing that.
He's traded fiddle strokes for golf strokes.
I'm sorry?
He's traded fiddle strokes for golf strokes.
Well, he probably traded nickels and dimes for all the fiddle strokes. But anyway, he's very secure in that career of his. And he never laid the fiddle down completely, but as time has gone on, he's more selective about what gigs he does play, and really cherishes the opportunity to get together with a bunch of guys and play the type of music that his dad played, which is so much a part of him.
Mm-hmm.
He went to most of the opera shows and television shows that they did locally here, from the late 50s on. Johnny was born in 56, so he came in right at the peak, really, of the Flatt & Scruggs era.
So you guys,
a lot of that stuff firsthand.
So Johnny must have then got up with you about, let's listen to these tapes, and I know what an audiophile you are. You must have went nuts when you found those old recordings and had a chance to listen to them.
Yeah, he called me and asked me about the characteristics of this tape, you know, because it had been sitting for 30-plus years. And I gave him the name of the studio over in Hendersonville, Tennessee. And one of their specialties is taking little real tapes. And there's a baking process where you actually heat the tapes up to soften them up because they become brittle over time. And you can get maybe one, maybe two plays out of the tapes. And of course, when you play it the first time, you have to go live to a disc. To catch it. So anyway, he took the tapes up there and walked out with permanent digital copies of everything.
Wow.
And from that point on, started showing me tunes that he wanted to learn and play, and those, that first set of tunes is what appears on Volume 1.
Yeah, in Volume 1, Earl sits in on one of those, doesn't he?
Yeah, we asked Earl to come over, and Johnny wanted him to play on Buck Creek Gal, which is his title, Dylan Banjo on the Carnegie Hall record.
Okay.
So Earl came over, and he and Johnny ran through the tune a couple of times and put it down and used the same fiddle and the same banjo. And,
wow. So,
historic advance.
So you got Paul Warren's fiddle, and you got Earl there with Earl's Granada. Then at that point,
right?
Wow! And you got you.
Well, I was watching.
You were watching.
It's only those two playing on that. But
okay.
It was a moment in time as far as recreating. A little slice of what made Earl Scruggs and Paul Warren.
Oh yeah. Great, and it's so great. And then you did a second album a little bit after that, did you not? Same kind of idea, a little
right.
bit.
Right. We had real good success with the first volume. I think we've done three pressings on that so far.
I bought one whole pressing, by the way.
One pressing is usually 1,000 units. And then if you sell that many in bluegrass in a short amount of time, I mean, that's no great number, but it happens so quickly.
Oh, yeah.
This box of tapes was very, you know, sizable amount of tunes. And Johnny said, hey, you know, this thing's going over pretty good. Let's dig back in these tunes. He said, I've got enough for at least a couple more tribute records. So. Then we started researching and changing the ideas, the format a little bit. We wanted to get, on the first record, Johnny wanted the presence of a Scruggs, a Graves, Seckler, and a Warren to record again.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we got Tim Graves placing dobro fiddles, and Curry played on a couple, played mandolin on a couple of tunes. And, anyway, he wanted to showcase that first package with family members or the actual members of the Foggy Mountain Boys to do the first record, and we had Marty Stewart come along and play some rhythm mandolin on that. And then the second record, we wanted to expound on maybe some of Paul's solos that he played instead of just pure fiddle tunes. Take some of the classic Scruggs banjo tunes and let him recreate the famous solos that his dad designed for those tunes, like Randy Van Rag and Old Folks. And so anyway, we started adding the banjo a little bit to it. And that record's done real well for us, too.
Oh, you know, and Charlie, they're both almost like historical documents, and I mean that in the sense that what you all did was try to recreate that sound, and you did such a great job. And I know you pay so much attention to what happens in the studio because your mind is set on that audio quality that you're always looking for. They're both just really excellent. What label are those on? I just forget. I don't have mine handy.
Well, we're not on a label, Steve. We, through my years of experience, it's great to be on a label, don't get me wrong, because they provide wonderful things for the artists. such as distribution, promotion. But, you know, it's just like going to the grocery store. If you buy something, you got to pay for it.
Right.
So, well, economically, it was better for us to have complete control over this and produce the weapons in a manner that we wanted to on the budget. That we wanted to, and we paid for it as we went, so we're not sitting in debt to a weapons company and having to pay inflated prices per unit.
Well, then my follow-up is, how do they get a hold of it? And I guess I bought mine from you directly, but how do people listening out there, how do they track these things down if they can't find them on a label?
Well, we have several outlets in which to go to purchase the records. First Sub Record Shop, County Sale, Northern Virginia, Janet Davis Music in Denver, Arkansas. You can contact me directly through my website, which is charliekushman.com. We're also available on Amazon.com. And maybe a couple of others. I think Elderly Instruments has my product up there. It's not something you're going to see when you walk in a music store, but we can get you picked up, you know, if you contact me or Johnny Eagle One or any of those outlets that I mentioned.
And it's more than worth tracking down, really. You know, Charlie, and I've been telling people for the last 2 weeks about, and maybe this ties in with your ability to hear these sounds, but you are regarded as, I think, the best setup man for banjos in the business. And I'm not going to take the time now because we can't do it, but I want you to explain a little bit about how you got into setting up banjos and what the heck do you do when someone says, here's a banjo, make it sound better.
If you like what I like, which is for your instrument to perform, and your investment to give you something back every time you pick it up, and being around the people that I've had the honor of being around all my life, these wonderful banjo players, some of these great old banjos, and I'm talking, you know, basically master tone banjos, pre-war instruments. People like Sonny Osborne, Betty Crowe, Curtis McPeak, you know, those guys get together sometimes and talk a little shop, you know, and hand each other banjos and here, play mine, see what you think, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, you know, and that's always gone as long as I can remember. That's why I arrived at Nashville and I had access to these people. Not so much that I sought out those things to do, but wonderful things happen when you have a lot of musicians living in a community or an area that's tight-knit as the banjo community.
Well,
Anyway, through experience, I guess, would be in a nutshell.
Well, but Charlie, you have to have great results or they're not going to find you even in a tight-knit community.
Well, thanks to guys like you who, publicize what I do, and I wish I had 100 customers like you.
Well, you mentioned those master tones, and I've heard them. And I know what you're trying to recreate, not that I could ever do it, but you can also go to Charlie and say, I want this banjo, because I've done this before, not a master tone, but you remember a year or so ago, I brought another banjo down to you, and I said, I want it the sound to be this way, and you